Okay, thanks to the organizers for inviting me. As some of you know, I'm usually working with the conformal field equations, but since some of you also have already heard a talk about conformal field equations, I thought I'll talk about something else that I spent some time recently on. And this is, as you see, discrete differential forms. What I want to say is, well, I want to start the talk basically with motivation, why one would be interested in looking into these kind of things in numerical relativity. And then I'll outline briefly what discrete differential forms are. I will present some formulation of the Einstein equations as a differential ideal, which is the thing you need if you want to apply differential forms. And then I'll discuss some issues in the discrete formulation. I should say this is all preliminary. There are just some ideas, and we are at the beginning of looking into these kind of things. So don't expect too much. Oops, motivation. When you're looking at the usual procedure when you're writing a code in order to study solutions of the Einstein equations, the usual procedure is like this. You have a set of geometric differential equations, Einstein equations, Young-Mills equations, conformal field equations, whatever you want. Oh, great. Then you, when you have them on a Lorentzian manifold, you can split them into evolution equations and constraints. And you have to verify that the constraints are propagated by the constraints if you want to have a complete solution of the set of these differential equations. This is done analytically. Now, once you have that the thing is analytically consistent, you can prove initial value, well postness of the initial value problem, and so on. And then you can put it on a computer by starting to discretize the evolution equations and the constraints. The first step is to solve the constraints in order to get initial data, and then you, after you've chosen coordinates or tetrad rotations and so on, you can start evolving the system. And during the evolution, we all know that the constraints will not be satisfied. So you may choose to have a free evolution, then you can use the constraints to check the quality of your numerically generated solution. Otherwise, you can choose to solve the constraints at every time step or some time steps in between and so on, and make use of the constraints and forget some of the evolution equations. And once you have your numerical solution, then you have to go back and extract the physical information, which means the information which is not dependent on the coordinates, basically. So this is the standard procedure. Now, there are problems with this, as we all know. And I think these problems come because we are doing the discretization after we have split the equations. This means that we split the equations into evolution equations and constraint equations, and then we treat them completely differently, more or less. So this means that the discretization of those two systems are not related in some way. So the discretization of the systems are independent. And this leads to the problems that we have, namely that the discrete versions of the equations are in general not compatible in the sense that the discrete evolution equations do not preserve the discrete constraints. And this leads to the things that we observe in our simulations, namely this exponential growth of constraint violation. constraint violation. Another thing which I put here on the problem, but it's just a feature which is present in geometric equations when you have something which fixes a geometry, that is that the equations are invariant under diffeomorphisms, meaning you can choose arbitrary coordinate systems. Now, this is in principle a good thing. You have a complete choice of in what kind of coordinates you want to describe the solution, but when you're doing numerical simulations, you have to make a choice. And because everything is equally possible, this is a difficult choice, and nobody knows really what the best choice for what situation is. So this means that you have to make a choice, and only after you have found your solution, you go back and extract the invariant information, the physical content of the solution. So what you're generating is, in general, coordinate dependent. And then one thing which has always bothered me is that when you're doing these numerical things, you're dealing with tensor fields, vector fields, and so on. But what you're doing in numerics is you write everything in terms of components with respect to a certain basis, and then you just deal with these as they were scalar equations. So the geometric character of the quantities in the game is basically lost. And then another thing is that so far the main emphasis has been on finite difference method, or recently more pseudo-spectral methods. But finite element methods have largely been ignored so far. So and what I want to present here is some kind of alternative approach which is related in a way to finite element method and which is intrinsically geometric. So let me come to the basic quantities in that game, namely the discrete differential forms. Let's first look at the left half, which you probably all know. So suppose you have given a manifold, differentiable manifold, then with this manifold you can find all kinds of submanifolds of various dimensions, p-dimensional submanifolds. If the p is zero, so we have a zero-dimensional submanifold, we would call this a point. One-dimensional submanifolds are a curve. Two-dimensionals are called surface. And differential forms come with various ranks, namely p-forms, and those p-forms are, as it's usually said, are the things that want to be integrated over p-dimensional submanifolds. So you can think of a p-form as simply being a map which assigns to every p-dimensional submanifold the integral of the p-form over the submanifold. So what you get is a map which assigns to every p-dimensional submanifold some number, some real number. There is also what's called the exterior derivative, which I denote here by the bold D. And this is related to this map by what's called the Stokes theorem, in the sense that the number that the exterior derivative of a p minus 1 form assigns to a p-dimensional submanifold is equal to the number that the p minus 1 form assigns to the boundary of that p-dimensional submanifold. So this is the Stokes theorem, which tells you the relationship between the exterior derivative, the integral of the exterior derivative of a p-form to the integral of the form over the boundary. Okay, now let's take this continuous left-hand side and go over to the discrete right-hand side. Instead of a manifold, a differentiable manifold, we now assume that we have triangulated somehow this manifold, and we only focus on the triangulation. So we only focus on these lines here. Corresponding to p-dimensional submanifolds in a triangulation, you can find p-simplices, it's called. So these are just the basic building blocks of a triangulation. A zero simplex is usually called a node. A one simplex is called an edge. And a two simplex is called a face, just from usual. Think of a tetrahedron where you have the points, the corners are the nodes, the edges and the faces you have. And then we take this way of looking at a p-form, and we say a discrete p-form is simply a map which assigns to every p-simplex in that triangulation a real number, okay? So this means a one-form, a discrete one-form, would be an assignment of a number to every edge in this triangulation. A two-form would be a number, a map which assigns a number to every area here, to every face in that triangulation. And a zero-form, a function, is something which assigns a value to every point in there. Okay. Now, we want to have something equivalent to the exterior derivative, because the exterior derivative is essentially the thing that gives us the derivatives when we are having differential equations. So we need something like that. And now we take this here, this Stokes theorem, and we simply define the exterior derivative as being the map which assigns a number given by the exterior, well, the discrete P form applied to the boundary of the simplex. So in this example here, this is a two simplex, which has boundary, which is bounded by these edges. And the value of, so if I take the D of a one form, a discrete one form, that would be a two form. So I would have to assign a number to this triangle here by using the numbers assigned by the one form on the edges. And there is one way which preserves the orientation, that is this definition here. So in this way, you can define the exterior derivative in terms of basically the Stokes theorem. So in this whole setup, the Stokes theorem is exactly verified, true, because it's a definition. Okay, the next thing we can do with differential forms is we can multiply them in the sense of the Grassmann product. So given a P form and a Q form, now on the continuous side, given a P form and a Q form, we know how to form a P plus Q form out of this. And this multiplication gives the set of all differential forms the structure of what's called a graded algebra. The grading comes because P and Q gives P plus Q. And it's a product which is not commutative, but the forms commute or anti-commute depending on the rank of the various factors in this kind of way. And the important property is how the exterior derivative relates to this wedge product. And that's what's called an derivation or derivation or antiderivation, depending on, again, on the rank of the forms. Namely, that you have this kind of a product rule. The D applied to a wedge product is equal to the sum of the D applied to one of each factors, and then there is a minus sign in between, which accounts for the rank of the first P form. And this is important here, this relationship. The whole setup here gives rise to what's called the Derham cohomology. You can get topological information from looking at the forms, topological information on about the manifold that these forms live on. Coming to the discrete side, we want something which mimics in a discrete way this product here. Now there is a general formula which allows you to express a P plus Q, the wedge product of a P and a Q form, a discrete P and Q form, in terms of the P form and the Q form. I do not write down the general formula because you see from the simple case here, it becomes complicated. Now these things here should actually be some brackets, but for some reason it comes out like this. So here is an example where you take two one forms, which gives you a two form. So you can evaluate this on this area, on this triangle. And it's basically a problem in combinatorics to find out the combination the combination you have to write down in order to get these something which is skew in these numbers here, which means that if you interchange any of these two vertices, basically you pick up a minus sign because you're changing the orientation of an edge, and thereby the orientation of the triangle, and which is such that it does not single out any of these vertices. So it's this unique combination up to a factor.
So how do you do a zero form times a one form?
Sorry?
Suppose you have a zero form times a one form. Zero form is different at each of the vertices?
That's given at each of the vertices, that's right.
If I multiply it by one form, I have to do some averaging or something?
Yeah, that's the usual way to do it, yeah. I mean, what you do is you take there is this whole thing called Whitney forms. So, you know, all this goes back to the 1950s or so, where you take a, given with a zero form, there is a unique Whitney form, which is a continuous form. And then you, what this amounts to is that you take the average of the two values in there. You get this assigns you a number to this edge, and then you can do this. Okay, now with this, depending on what kind of factor you're using here, that is the factor here is in fact fixed by the demand that the discrete D should be a derivation in that sense, so that we should have this formula also on the discrete level. This fixes the factor here in front.
But it also fixes the whole combination.
Yes.
The unique solution.
Yeah. I don't know. I think there is one, yes, because I mean this is just really combinatorics where you do not want to single out the any vertex, and you know what has to come out, because basically if you take this as equal to dx and this is equal to dy, then you want to get the area of the triangle basically.
Right.
I think that fixes it, yeah, but I do not know whether this is a theorem or not. Okay, now all this what I was saying here is basically well known in algebraic topology, and this gives rise, as this here gives rise to the Jerome cohomology, this is called the singular cohomology. Okay, now you may ask, where are differential forms in the Einstein equations? So I will tell you about the Einstein equation as a differential ideal. Now, the basic variables are forms, obviously. And the one thing, well, the basic thing here is a tetrad. So we choose a covariant tetrad, meaning four one forms, which are a basis in your cotangent space. And the other thing is a connection form, which has value in the Lie algebra of the Lorentz group. So this is, again, a one form, which has matrix indices in a way, and it's a skew in these indices. If you lower this index with this thing here, which I just talked about in a second, then it's skew in this in the indices I and k. So these are the basic variables, and because we are looking here at an SO13 connection, we have in addition this what I call space-time metric. Well, it's the expression of the space-time metric in that basis. So it's a constant matrix which has this signature. So this is a thing which is floating around this whole setup, which is given to us. And it is important that it's given to us, because this really describes basically the light cone structure. It gives us the causality of the whole setup. And then, because we want to look at Lorentzian manifolds with a connection, we have the structure equations by Cartan, which are given in this way. I will not discuss this here. This is basically the equation which gives you the Christoffel symbols in terms of the metric. You can discuss it like that. And this gives you the Riemann tensor components in terms of the Christoffel symbols. So this is also something which is given to you once you have decided to look at the Lorentzian manifold. And then from these two equations, you can derive the Bianchi identity, which, as we all know, is necessary, or is an important ingredient in the setup. Now, it's important to note that the Bianchi identity follows from these equations simply by the rules that I was stating before, namely that the D is a derivation and that the wedge product has the properties that it's that these forms are a graded algebra. So just by applying the algebraic rules to these two equations, you arrive at the Bianchi identity. Okay, now this is, so far there is no Einstein equations. This is the setup for a general manifold. The Einstein equations come with this structure, which are what's usually called the Nestor-Witten form. So these are four, as you can see, two forms. And they use all of this in these forms. There is all the information that I was mentioning. It's the basic variables, the tetrad, the connection, and this index here has been raised with the metric, with this eta ik. So all the things are present in this two form. And now again, you compute the exterior derivative of these two forms, and you find it's just an identity to find here. This equation here, which means that you can express the exterior derivative of the Nestor-Witten form as, which is now a three form. It's the sum of two forms, three forms. First one of which is quadratic in the connection, and the other one contains only curvature components. And in fact, the combination here works like that the only part of the curvature which appears in this here is exactly the Einstein tensor. So if we want to impose the Einstein equations, we have to put this term here equal to zero. And then you see what we find is this equation here, which says that this three form S here is exact. It's the exterior derivative of a two form. And if it's exact, then it's, in particular, it is closed. So we get this equation here. So imposing the Einstein equations implies that this three form here is closed. And now Sparling has, some 20 years ago, has shown that if this three form here is closed, you can derive the Einstein equations from it. So this equation here, the ds is equal to zero, is equivalent to imposing the Einstein equations. And this being closed here, or saying that s is a closed form, means that locally, I can write it like that. So I can write the d of L is equal to f.
Sorry,
yep.
Being stupid, I think, but I don't understand how you separate out the s and the e.
Oh, this is just by simple. You take a d of this, right? You have to take the d of the omega, and you have to take a d of the theta. The d of omega is computed from this. The d of omega is you use this equation that brings in curvature and terms which are quadratic in omega. And the other term involves the d of theta, which already has an omega, but that using this equation, you find again that it's a term comes up which is quadratic in omega and has a theta. So you get terms, different kind of terms, which are either quadratic or curvature, right? So there is a unique way to split this. What do you mean by covariant? Yeah, these are. I mean, this works for every choice of frame, but it refers to a frame. Yeah. Okay, so the system that we get is this thing here, which expresses the fact that our connection should be torsion free. And this one, which expresses the fact that the curvature of the connection should be satisfy the Einstein equations. This is a two-form equation. This is a three-form equation. And as you mentioned, there is gauge freedom in the whole setup. I can choose any tetrad that I want, or I can rotate the tetrad, and these equations remain invariant. Okay, now this system here is written entirely in terms of forms, and it uses only the structures that I've written down earlier, which characterize the forms, the algebra of forms. Okay, before I come to the...
Conceptually, there's a big difference, though, because previously you're considering forms, and here, of course, you have all
these
indices, which you think of as an internal indices.
Of course, yes.
But previously, it was if I really had a genuine form with no internal indices, then, as you said, if I'm given one form, then if I'm given a curve, I get a number.
Right.
Just integrate the form.
Sure.
But now I don't really get a number.
No, you get four numbers from looking at
those
the
numbers don't have any physical meaning at all. I mean, I'll
tell you. Just wait a second. Okay, before I come to this, I will tell you something about the applications of this exterior system. You can find this in all kinds of disguises and things. The first incidence of this identity that I wrote down dl equals s plus e is in Einstein's energy balance for the energy in a gravitational field. And then you see that this the three form s that I mentioned is related to the pseudo energy momentum tensors. You can apply this identity to various these are three forms, so you can integrate them over three dimensional manifolds. If you integrate them over a null hypersurface, you find the law, well, basically the Ray-Chiodori equation in integrated form. If you integrate them over Scry, you find the Bondi-Maslow's law. And they are also, when you integrate them over space-like hypersurfaces, you can, under certain conditions, relate them to the positive mass theorem or the Penrose inequality. So these are the contents of this exterior, well, the of this exterior system, of this identity, is really a physical thing which has all kinds of implications for basically energy.
Yeah, I don't think you can get Penrose inequality from
Yeah, I can show you. I mean, no proof of this, but you can, it's the same kind of status as with the Gerosch argument on a time symmetric hypersurface. You have to show that certain flows exist in this.
That's why you call one theorem and another only equal.
Exactly, yes. Okay, now how do you apply this in the discrete formulation? So you think of, given your space-time as being given by basically discrete building blocks, which are four simplices. What you have to do is you have to choose the topology of your time slices, certainly of the initial time slice, and then you have to start triangulating and setting building the manifold in by putting in the building blocks. And the equations that you look at are these equations that I just wrote down, where you just replace the differential forms by discrete forms. You can just do this because we have the same kind of notions. We have the exterior D. Okay, four slices, slides. So this is simply interpreting these equations in terms of the discrete forms. The discrete variables now are the thetas, the tetrad, and the connection one forms, evaluated, because these are one forms, so they are evaluated on edges. So with every edge in the triangulation, I get four numbers from the tetrads and six numbers from the connection. The geometric meaning of this, now I come back to your question, of these variables is pick an edge. So this is a curve, basically, in space-time, connects two events, and you can, given the four numbers which are assigned to that edge by the thetas, you can make this combination here, and this is obviously what you would interpret as the space-time distance between those two events. In particular, you can say whether these two events are space-like separated, time-like separated, or null, depending on the sign of this thing here, because you know that this eta here is floating around, and it's always there. The other meaning, the meaning of this omega ik here, is you get, with this edge, you get six numbers which make up an element in the Lie algebra of SO13. So this is an infinitesimal Lorentz rotation. And if you exponentiate this in the sense of Lie algebra, making a Lie group element out of it, you find that this is a Lorentz rotation. And you can interpret this as being the rotation, the relative rotation between the given frame, the thetas, which is sitting someplace on at this point and this point, and the frame that you get by parallelly transporting this frame along the edge to that event q. That gives you a difference, a Lorentz rotation, by which these two frames differ, and this thing here is supposed to be an approximation for that Lorentz rotation. So it's the interpretation of these things here is what's called the holonomy, which you get from transporting from P to Q. And because it's the holonomy, there is a very close relationship. If you transport things along a closed curve, then the holonomy gives you some information about the amount of curvature inside that curve. So this variable here is really related to the curvature content of the space-time. Okay, now we have to choose gauges. We have to know something about how we choose the tetrad. So because we are free to orient the tetrad in an arbitrary way, I will say something about how you choose this later on. And then we have these equations, these exterior equations, which are two-form equations or three-form equations. So we have to evaluate them on two, respectively three, simplices, which are two approximations to two-dimensional manifolds or three-dimensional manifolds. And this will give you, when you just look at the equations, algebraic nonlinear system of equations for these quantities here. Now, this is done for the entire system. Now we can split this. So we discretize and then we split. So it's the other way around than in the usual approach. We can split this into evolution equation and constraints by now looking basically at, what's a constraint equation? A constraint equation is such an equation which we get by evaluating on a simplex where all the nodes are space-like separated, right? So this means that they span a piece of a space-like hypersurface, and that gives us a constraint. And all the other equations are evolution equations. It's the same kind of argument getting the constraints in the from the differential equations. You're looking for those which do not contain time derivatives. So you can split these equations by looking at the causal character of the simplices. And what is really important is, I think, that the Bianchi identities are identically satisfied, because you get the Bianchi identities by this algebraic procedure, taking a D and then combining terms and so on. And this algebraic, the algebraic properties are the same for the differential forms and for the discrete forms. So,
I saw a different version of this in which there was a problem at the last step that came about because of the breakdown of the distributive or associative law for multiplication. In other words, if you take d omega plus omega wedge omega and take its d, you still have to plug in and use the associative.
I don't see that here.
Okay,
because
that's very nice if so.
Because you see, you have to be careful how you make this multiplicative law in the discrete way. That's what that refers to Abai's question, I think,
in
some way.
I mean, we should sit through it. But I mean, I think you start with the Dirac cohomology. I think what you really have to start with the non-immediate cohomology and generalize that. Because you're talking about holonomies here. These omega one forms of holonomies. I mean, Dirac cohomology was not.
It's scalars, I know, yeah.
It's logarithmic holonomies. So it's not clear to me that you can just take all the discrete version of the Dirac cohomology here and get something meaningful. So that maybe.
Maybe you can tell me more about what your problem is. Yeah. Okay. Now, as I say, the Bianchi identity are identically satisfied. Actually, I've verified this. I mean, you can really go through the computation and show that it's true. And this is of course essential for the consistency of the equations, meaning that basically the constraints are. Yeah. are propagated by the evolution equations. Okay, and the whole setup here is geometrical, which means that we never talked about any coordinates. So in this way, it is independent of coordinates. Now, one thing before I stop, I have to stop probably, is how you get the time step. I mean, suppose you start with some initial hypersurface, and then you want to go to the next step. Think of this hypersurface, which is a three-dimensional hypersurface, as being triangulated with tetrahedra. A tetrahedron has four points. Now you think of this at each point of the tetrahedron, you construct its future light cone. So you get four light cones, and generically these light cones will intersect in one point, at one later point. So that means that from these three points here in this drawing, you can construct a unique point in the next time level. And these edges here are then by construction null edges. So this point is null separated from all these points in there, and this point here is unique. So with triangulation of a hypersurface, we will get a dual triangulation of the next hypersurface. And this corresponds to staggering grids, basically. And then if we go to the next one, we come back to the triangulation of that character here. Now, because the propagation speed is exactly the light speed, we have, with this kind of construction, the CFL condition basically built in. This is the CFL condition means that discrete domain of dependence and analytic domain of dependence are related in a certain way. And by doing this construction, we have basically taken care of the CFL condition. And now with this one, suppose you're sitting there and you're watching these two points, then you will see them, you will see simultaneously four light flashes, basically. And these come in certain directions, and you can use these directions to at least partially fix the Lorentz frame. I will not go into the details here because Lewis wants me to stop. Okay, but this is the last slide anyway. So at the moment we are looking at simple cases, namely 1+1 system, where we have imposed a spherical symmetry, and the other possibility is to look at PP waves. What we want to do is find out how you find the propagation character of these equations, in particular for this case, the PP waves, how the hyperbolic character comes about. And then we have various questions, of course, having to do with how to choose the tetrad and boundary conditions and so on. But I think the way this thing here is geometrically constructed, I think makes it kind of useful and interesting to look at. So thank you.
Chair Garrison.